Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Well, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and Adam. Adam Barrett's on the line with me again today.
Hey, Fred. How's it going?
Hey. You know, recently, I know that you've been working on creating an accelerated life testing. I don't have all the details. You've asked me just a handful of questions, but it sounds like you're asking a lot of the right questions. So I thought, let's talk about the process of designing an ALP, because you're not the only one that's asked me about this recently. So there must be a flurry of people wanting to know how long something will last in this realm. But and you've got some experience doing ALPs, I suspect. So why all the questions?
So, yeah, I mean, the questions come down to the different perspective. From the customer's perspective, when I consult on a project, a lot of times the person you're speaking with has some project management accountability, and they want to know, okay, when will I, their question is, when will this device wear out? It's supposed to have a five-year life, and we can't wait 5 years to find out if it has it or not. We need an accelerated test. And their question is, how fast can you tell me, you know, so I can put it in my project schedule that we have confirmation of its wear out? And how many test units do I have to give you to get there? Those are their first two questions. And they want to know, tell me in 3 months that it'll last 5 years, or is it going to take you a year or 2 years? Because that obviously has a big impact on their schedule.
Right. And, you know, usually the launch date is set, and then we kind of work backwards on a lot of product development teams. And so at some point, somebody's going to ask, well, will this last long enough? And, oh, we need to know by October 1st next year, because that's our go, no go on shipping this thing. And then they very quickly say, well, earlier would be better, because if there's a problem, we need to change it, and that will take time.
Yep.
Right. And so it can, and we've seen this. I know you've worked with startups that their primary focus is get to revenue, get the product out there, get started shipping. And then I actually had a customer call me shortly after Christmas, after the Christmas season. They had shipped, I think, 70,000 units for the Christmas market. And by January 1st, 50,000 had failed.
Yikes.
And so they, one of the things, it was supposed to be like a bracelet. It's similar to a Fitbit, but it wasn't Fitbit. And a bracelet kind of electronics product. And it was and even their advertising showed it in the shower or, you know, swimming activity type monitor. And so they went and did some standard testing, and they looked at what watches go through for moisture testing. So they said, well, you dunk it in a bucket of water that's 3 feet deep for 10 seconds. You pull it out, shake off the excess water, and see if it powers up. And it did. It was fine. But all of those units failed a week later. But they didn't recognize that as a problem. And so they redesigned and did a bunch of other stuff. And there's a bunch of other stories that they did is they had a little robot, and it was a flexible device, and they had a robot that would extend it out to its full spread, basically, and then you track, let it go back to its normal shape, and then it would pull it back out and so on. And it was just straight line, pull, open and close. Well, the way people used it, though, it had all kinds of exotic twists and turns and bends and stuff like that. And so the question was, how does that robot relate to how many days of actual use it has? We had no idea. We didn't have a model. So we tested it and found it to be, if you got 8,000 cycles with a robot, it was worth about 1,500 to 2,000 cycles in real life. And so that completely threw a wrench in the works, because this was supposed to be used every day, not taken on and off multiple times per day, and it just wasn't going to work. But in each of those cases, there was a step back in saying, hey, we really need to know if this will last long enough. And then I think then the next question is, just as you mentioned, Adam, is that, well, what's my sample size? You know, is it, what's this going to cost me?
Yeah, so the hard part is, if you are familiar with any of the common equations like the inverse power law or Arrhenius model or any others, there's always variables in there that are factors that are driven specifically by the actual device and its application. And even slight changes in these factors can have a big change in the outcome, in the acceleration factor. So truly, any really good accelerated life test that you can have a lot of confidence in the result, and that scaling factor, especially if you're doing very aggressive stresses, is one that was preceded by a set of tests that help you define those factors. And it's not just something you look up in a material table. It's very specific to the usage.
And the design. That particular structure, combinations of materials, the adhesives or construction, all of that matters.
Customer does not want to hear that. Yeah, the customer doesn't want to hear, okay, good, let's start our investigation study. And then, you know, so not only am I not going to tell you how long this test will take, I'm also telling you I have to schedule another set of tests in advance before, just so I can tell you how long the other tests will take, you know? And they're like, oh boy, you know, like you're going to lose the job, basically. And that's hard. And
It is. Wayne Nelson wrote the book, in my mind, called On Accelerated Testing.
It's actually under my hand right now. It's on my desk right here. That's funny you say that. Yeah.
And if you look at the copyright on that thing, it's I think 1980, something like that.
Let's see. I'm getting it. Well, the other thing that's amazing about it, if you look at the references in it, like when you're looking at the equations and stuff, so many of his references are like from the 40s. And I mean, they go way
back. This isn't new. In the 50s and 60s, are lots of industries, especially the military servicing industries, realized that they needed to make products that lasted. And that if we understood the failure mechanism, whether it was metal fatigue or corrosion or whatever, that if we understood that, then we could design products that would meet the requirements, or we would have to go to a new technology.
1990.
Okay, so I'm off by a decade.
That's so funny that the book was just right here, right in front of me.
Yeah, well, like you mentioned earlier, well, I guess that kind of you're working on it. Yeah,
this but is it's, being a current topic.
And so I had the chance to sit down with Wayne once, and he's helped me so much over the years, even from the very first test I did back in the mid-90s. But he has been very, very gracious and very, he's published hundreds and hundreds of papers. He's got these books out, and he's very, very helpful. But I asked him one time, he says, how do you design an accelerated test? I've got this new material or this strange mechanical system or this widget that I don't have a prior work on. How do you go about designing it? How do you design the perfect test? And he said, that's easy. Ship them, give them to your customers and track failures and do good root cause analysis to figure out what the failure mechanism is. And then you'll have perfect information of what fails and when. So then you can design a test to match that result. Wow, that doesn't sound too useful. Thanks, Wayne.
Right.
But it's true, right? In order for us to say how many samples I need to know the variability. I need to know that variance term. And if I don't have that variance term, where do I get it? If I can't run a previous prior experiment, is it a guess or is it the literature? Is it, where do I get that number? And then, like you said, an inverse power law, Arrhenius, Coughlin-Nansen equation, there's Black's equation, there's a bunch of cool equations that are out there, hundreds and hundreds of these models. They were done the brute force way, where I ran lots of experiments at different stresses and I created a correlation between just basic regression between the stresses and the time to failure. And then those became our constants. And like you said, it's just a small change in those constants can really dramatically change your results. So when we're pushed by time, we don't have a lot of samples, we need to get something going. If we just run three samples and put them in high temperature without stepping back and making sure that that's relevant to answer the question of how long will these last, we could really be wasting a lot of time and resources.
So here's the question to our listeners and where we can ask them for help. So a lot of times if people don't want to allow that investigation to happen, or the investigation testing to happen, you know, kind of enforcing to pull it from books and tables. Mm-hmm. When I do that, I am conservative with the level of stress I do over. I obviously don't want to get extremely, you know, push it high, because what if you start going into areas where it's no longer something that correlates?
Melt it, for example. I've done that before.
Yeah.
I cut stuff on fire. I figured I had a little bit too much heat in there.
But yeah, exactly. But even far before that, you know, when you don't see that destruct, but you've started to change the wear out failure mode types that would happen in the field, then it's not apparent because it's not like flat out melted or something.
That's right.
So I'm trying to keep a conservative value. They're pushing for a faster test with, you know, without allowing this pretest. I would love for our listeners to comment on that. What do you do? What does the consultant say? How do you work that out? Because they want to hear that they can do it quick, but it's either way is going to take the same time. Either you do the investigation work and then you can do a more aggressive test, or you do a less aggressive test based on index tables. But it's, you know, it's going to take longer.
This it's a mix of engineering and risk management is the way I think of it. We need to know where the phase transitions are. We need to understand if we have previous failures or even prototype failures. What do we know about the corrosion path, or what do we know about the metal fatigue or that kind of metal? Yeah. So there's some material science. There's all kinds of cool engineering stuff we can do to bound that problem of what's the range of stresses we can apply, even without a solid model to put it all together.
Yep.
The other part of it, though, is that, well, if you want this answer tomorrow, there's a very high likelihood that it will be wrong, right? I'll run one sample and I'll guess and say it's good or not good. And the chance of me being wrong is very, very high. Where if I go, I'll be a little bit more conservative. I need 22 samples and we'll run them to failure. It's going to take me 3 to 6 months to get results.
Yep.
I'll be more accurate. There's still uncertainty. Now, if you want to be perfect, well, it's back to Wayne Nelson's advice.
Just right.
Ship them and track it, and then you know what the number is. And that has its own risk.
But here's the problem. That conversation, well, not the problem, but here's what's running through my head when I'm having that conversation. I'm having that conversation with that person and they're saying yes or no, or let's do this. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, these results, in my mind, I'm like, they're going to get reported to, you know, other parts of the program and to help make big decisions.
That's right.
And they're not going to be considering the fact that, you know, I'm doing this with a lower confidence than I would like. And that's the kind of thing that keeps you up at night as a reliability engineer, right? I'm like, okay, I'm going to tell them that when they get these results, that translates that they can have confidence in a 5-year life. When in fact, I know a lot of the driving factors we took, you know, the best swag at, but I wouldn't, you know, if these were brakes on a car we were doing, I wouldn't stand in front of it when you tested it, because I'm not that sure. I'm not feeling that kind of confidence.
Hopefully, I mean, last episode you talked about getting a new car. So the brakes are okay.
My brakes are okay, yeah.
Okay, all right, just checking.
They haven't worn out.
That's right, that's good. So it's been just a little while, so hopefully that's been fine.
Yeah.
So I know exactly what you're talking about is that, I mean, we can write a report with all the caveats and assumptions and everything else, and I think that's due diligence. When we design a test, we say, here's where the risk is. It's not just sample size. There's risk that we're testing the wrong thing, or that we're masking the real problem, or here's all the other engineering assumptions we've made. I think be honest and clear about that. Here's the trade-offs. Here's what we know and don't know. Yet when we do the analysis and we send up the report, you're exactly right. We're going to look to the executive summary and say, will it last 5 years or not with some probability? And go make a decision based on that.
It's binary. It's yes or no. They'll be like,
it really is. Good? Yeah.
Okay. You know, and it's, and you know, you're aware of that, and that's reality. But it's nice to know that they're making that decision and you're giving the information based on like an 80% statistical confidence or something. You're like, I can live with that level of risk. But when you push to give an answer and you're like, I have a 30% confidence in this, that's nerve wracking.
Well, it's also, I mean, I've heard this before from engineering directors I've worked with that said, you know, we got to make decisions based on what we have available. And, you know, we're not doing a parts count prediction, or we're not doing just engineering judgment on this, because we know it's important to know, will this flange support the weight for the desired amount of time, or whatever the product is? Will it work long enough and durable enough, and low enough failure rate? And yes, we can't get a perfect answer, but it looks like we're thinking through to get as good an answer as we can. And as long as we're clear about that, then that's what we have to work on. But if I've got 6 months, I can do a whole lot better job of getting a decent answer than if it's 2 weeks from now, depending on what it is. But sometimes 6 months isn't enough either to get a really clean answer. You shouldn't plan for 6 months to find the perfect test. You really do need to get started and get something in the works and get your plan together and think through and get it reviewed and then get samples going. You still need to make a decision. So I think keeping that in mind is the critical piece.
Yeah, well, if anything, this is a good therapy session. It's good to know that other people feel that pressure and feel the uncertainty of it too, because you walk away feeling like, wow, I should have the answer for them. You know, like if I was better, I would have the answer. But the reality is, you know, you're kind of pushing the limits of physics, you know, and what you could, there's so many variables and boundary conditions in these, you know, setups that, yeah, you can't just pull it out of a book.
Well, and if it is in the book, then I wouldn't run the test. Yep. You know, if there's 100 previous studies for ball grid solder joint fatigue, I would just use the formula.
Yeah,
I don't need to run the test.
Yeah,
but we get asked, and every company is designing products that are unique in unique markets, unique applications, unique construction, whatever. And that's what makes, well, the reliability world a lot of fun, because we get to go break stuff in different ways. But we do it and hopefully can come up with an answer at the end of it.
Yeah. So the big question is, do I owe you a $20 copay for this therapy session?
Or... Well, what is it? What do they call it? Out of area expenses?
Or
what
out of network.
Out of network.
Yeah, oh, no. Sorry, that would be full price. Wait.
I'll have my lawyer call you.
What are your rates? Oh,
no. No, we should come back to this ALT stuff, since I think you're going through it and I fielded this question a number of times, and actually working on a project now is getting started to create an ALT. So it is something that we should, there's lots of statistics, there's lots of formulas, there's lots of models out there. Yet it tends to come down to, we're going to have to make some engineering based assumptions here, and where do we start? How do we get through that? And then I think another whole topic is how do you present reliability information so that it's understood, not just that binary go no go, which is the ultimate result we want, but it's usually a little more gray than that, without being too worried about it. So anyway, Adam, let's wrap up here and come back and talk about ALT and how that fits into the rest of the organization. And we can also dive into some more of the technical stuff. But as the audience, as you're listening to this, I'm sure it hopefully was therapeutic also. But more importantly, maybe it's sparked a few questions for you. So please let us know what's on your mind or what kind of questions you'd like us to discuss. If you get a chance, get over to iTunes and leave us a rating or review. Very, very helpful for us to build an audience here. But more importantly, we'd like to hear from you. So with that, Adam, I think we're about ready to sign off.
Sounds good. I'll look for the bill.
All right. Well, thanks, Adam. Talk to you again.
Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.